This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 9th of November, 1953. The title of this lecture is Exteriorization by Feeling. This tape is 30 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions. Please note, this tape ends abruptly as did the original master recording.
Today, I'm going to take up more specifically clinical procedure. And if some of our guests find this incomprehensible, I take it all down, and sometime in the future it will become very confusing to an auditor. November 9th, afternoon lecture. We have this afternoon the material for our clinical procedure, the step which is known as exteriorization by feeling. I can call this by negative feeling, but that might give you a slightly erroneous idea of it. Now, two or three, I had this work done this morning, and I checked over quickly to see what they were doing and what was happening. And, of course, I found out that the boat was being slightly missed here and there. And did you use it? Did you use it with any success? Exteriorize anybody suddenly, inexplicably?
Ran up some stuff.
Did you exteriorize him? Did he say so?
Largely.
He didn't do that. Well, the reason for that, actually, I didn't check with Dick. I checked a couple of times. Just see how much data I have to give you on this. You know, data's getting valuable, and I have to make it scarce. the actuality is this is too easy. This is the only thing wrong with what we're doing now. It is insufficiently complex. And a mind goes up against it and begins to get baffled. And it gets more and more baffled because, of course, what one is trying to make it look at is just plain, ordinary, routine simplicity. So, in the final analysis, you find out that looking gets condensed and becomes feeling emotionally, and that gets condensed and becomes feeling in terms of effort, and that gets condensed and becomes thinking, and that gets condensed and becomes artificial communication systems, the first of which is words, and that gets real condensed and you get a messed universe. Now, the person who is taking the motorcycle down the road, of course, treats all this lower hard solidity with some contempt, but the person who is being taken down the road by a motorcycle, of course, knows the only thing real is an impact. Therefore, he gaily subscribes to electric shocks and bops on the nose and so forth, because this makes things real certain. And this certainty is something that is beyond price and actually should be handed out so scarcely that one never even tells an auditor he has it. It is the scarcest thing of all, certainty, because a person begins to get certainty from impacts. What does an impact tell a person? Simply tells him he's not there. Well, this is a negative certainty, and we finally get this to a point where the individual believes that he is not there. How does he do this? He looks at a tree just before he hits it on this motorcycle, which is taking him across the highways and off the highways and through the culvert and into the tree. And just before he hits the tree, he says, he doesn't say it this slowly, but actually if he was in good communication condition, he would say it about this slowly. Well, what do you know? There is a tree. My, I am sure certain that it's there and I'm here. Only he never really has enough chance to get out the I'm here part of it, you see. It locates him perfectly and beautifully and then makes a great big ridge. And because he, as a Thetan, believes himself to be subjected to gravity, if a motorcycle is taking him down the road, believe me, he believes in gravity. He really believes in it. And he just simply goes forward into the ridge. And what does the ridge say? The ridge says, I'm not there. Well, you see, he is in the ridge, which is saying, I'm not there. Now, this is rather confusing and is actually the state of mind of a person who doesn't exteriorize easily. All you have to do is take apart this problem. He is getting his certainty on the fact that things aren't there. Well, one of the easiest ways to do it is simply get him to shut his eyes and look into the blackness he sees in front of him and say, where are you in that blackness? And he'll say, I'm not anyplace. If you keep this up for a little while, however, a great deal of uncertainty turns on. When that uncertainty turns on, he has only one perception left, and that's the perception of feeling. When feeling turns on, now he's all set, except an auditor indoctrinated into certainty through looking or certainty through messed hand feeling might never consider that a thing can feel too. All that's happened to this person is the same thing that's happened to the matter and energy which has been put out in this universe. It's gotten too condensed. So he's too condensed. He doesn't have enough space. Well, condensation then brings him down into these grades. Feeling, emotion. Feeling, effort. And thinking compulsively or reactively. And then finally, words, and then other communication systems, such as the deaf and dumb alphabet, or Western Union telegrams. Very complex communication systems. Now, this person believes that communication is very complex and that it takes time to communicate. They're convinced of this. They're not convinced of anything else. They're convinced that it takes time to, well, sort of think it over and come to a conclusion. Not do anything rash, you know, make any motions about it, because we have to consider the problem. And it seems to them, well, they don't know, but it seems to them that they'd better set up a very, well, you know, a sort of a complex system which has many relay points which are not quite discoverable, and many fixed beams which will never be moved, on which they themselves can travel as a particle, because they're not a source and they're not an effect. Actually, they're just a communication particle running on a complex system. Now, you can see your Preakler as a communication particle. He'd be very, very happy if he's very, very, very difficult to exteriorize. He'd be very happy to have a postage stamp put on him and shoved in a mailbox, because he's a message on its way. And that's about all he is. He isn't the source of the message. He is the message. Now, of course, people get down further on this, and they don't dare arrive. Why don't they dare arrive? Well, they don't dare arrive because if they arrived, they'd be an effect, and they know what an effect is. Pow! A bit of the nose, that's an effect. And they don't dare be a source, because every time anybody is a source, somebody takes something away from a source. See, that's real bad. Now, you set up two things with this person. You have him mock up some things, or just get an idea. Have him take his wallet out and put it on the desk in front of him, then you take it out and carry it out into the hall. He won't like this. Something's being taken away from him. Hardly anybody likes that in this society, which has as its mutual anchor points dollars. So, with this, you try to give this person something, and he won't accept it. If a child is driven frantic by anything, it is parents to whom he can contribute nothing, or parents who take everything away from him. And these two things make up, in the final aggregate, aberration. Simply because the parents can't be cause and they can't be effect. In other words, they can't be the source of a message or the receipt point of a message. They certainly can't be. Now, this person finally hangs up further and further into the middle between A, source point, B, receipt point, gets stuck in the middle fixedly, and fights everything off and holds everything off, and at length comes into the happy, happy, happy frame of mind that now he's the only one. He's completely out of communication. Completely. All right, that's the dwindling spiral which we're looking at. All right, there's many ways then you could treat this thing. Just as you look at this problem is not very complex. Here you have a life unit. How big is a life unit? It's infinitesimally small, but a Preakler generally considers that he has a fate and has some mass. How big is this mass? Well, it's there. Generally, they're about the size of a beam or something of that sort. But they can be real big the moment they start to occupy lots of space. But of course, they're not a space-occupying agent. In their best sense, they're a space-observing agent. They are a source of looking. And they put effects down at the other end to look at. People start treating each other this way as mock-ups, originally on the track, and they start setting up beautiful mock-ups of things, and then after a while these mock-ups get more and more solid, and then they set them up to run automatically, and at length you have people. They do this because they get tired of playing chess by being on both sides of the board. So they say there's somebody else on the other side of the board. Now I'm going to forget he's me, and that's the end of him, as far as I'm concerned, because he's my randomity and he isn't I anymore. Period. So they have a chess player who is self-determined and who works on a self-determined pattern, which is a novel and interesting pattern to the other chess player. Now, for all intents and purposes, a few minutes after this mitosis, and this is the pattern of mitosis, took place, you would not be able to find out which was the original. But if you start making people blow up this automatic machine, which makes somebody else and sets up this automatic machine called somebody else, they just set up a machine called somebody else who is my randomity. Now I have forgotten about him. There'll probably be a lot of people collapse here and there over the universe, but we'd probably wind up with some fairly decent citizens. Now, everybody has done this, one way or another, and even if he only did it in this lifetime, and he took a little doll that had been given him for Christmas, boys play with dolls too, and said, "You are a bad doll, now, for saying the things you said, and so forth, and I'm going to punish you." Which he spanks the doll. The doll has personality. It's an other being. And if he keeps this up, he eventually is quite convinced of the personality of this doll. This doll is another person. But, much more importantly, he'll do this to a cat, and he will invest a cat, or he'll invest a dog with another personality. And he will ask the dog's opinion, he'll ask the cat's opinion about this and about that, and they'll have a terrific discussion on the matter. And the first thing you know, he can't tell the difference between himself and a cat. Very often, a little girl will show up, or a little boy will show up, but when they start to talk, they only mew, or they bark. And they do this for a little while, and then they get over it ordinarily. One little girl, particularly notable case, learned how to open the door, or get people to open the door, rather, simply by crawling up the steps on all four legs and scratching at the door and whining. That's with the age of about a year and a half. By the age of two, the child had discovered that this whining and so forth could be dispensed with, that one merely reached for the door. At Harvard University, where they carry on some scientific experiments, I am told, I lectured there once, so they teach something. I lectured on the short story one time, gave a series of lectures on the subject of the short story. After I finished up talking mainly about communication and so forth, they said you had to write an awful lot, and you had to write a couple of 100,000 words before you knew you had a style. A couple of 100,000 words at least. I could see the audience, these kids wilting. And so I said, "Well, 500,000 gives you a better idea of what your style is." It's wilted some more. And I said, "But you never really get going until you've written about 4 or 5 million words." I expected a few of them to collapse. Afterwards, they confessed to one another they couldn't see that this was possible, that they had their career mapped out as they had written a short story, and they were starting on their next short story next year. And they didn't want to write professionally. There was something nasty about that, which was the reason why they couldn't start out by writing 100,000 words. Anyway, this high communication unit, this high communication unit up there, one time conducted probably the only valuable scientific experiment ever conducted on the grounds of Harvard. Wonderful experiment. Gorgeous. They took a baby, and they took a baby orangutan, and they put them both together in the same cage. Maybe this was Yale. they put both of these together in the same cage, and they raised them in the same cage. And it all went along fine. The baby, I think it was a baby chimp. Baby orangutan. Baby orangutan came along just fine. And the baby and the baby orangutan were neck and neck for about 18 months, something on that order. And they were going to draw enormously huge, powerful, and earth-shaking conclusions from this entire experiment, except that the baby's grandparents happened to come down one day and noticed that the baby was scratching itself this way. That was the end of the experiment. Well, this demonstrated that the baby's body grew faster than the orangutan's body because it could scratch harder. Anyway, they concluded this, and it's gone down into deathly scientific archives. So we have done something in universities, and I don't like you people running universities down all the time. They do have good football teams. Anyway,
this lecture is continued on side two of this cassette.
The wonderful idea of matching up an animal and a child is actually just a dramatization. The little girl will outgrow, but you know the pet, the tragedy of the pet. as an auditor, you should recognize this, the tragedy of the pet. Change of space processing where the pet died is one of the most effective things you'll ever do. Why? Because the kid took the pet. And he says, now you are another being, and now I've forgotten all about you. And the pet's just a pet. And after this, he talks to a circuit called other being. And then one day somebody feeds the pet strychnine or catches its back in the door or it gets run over by an automobile. And what happened? The PC died. A piece of him died right there. Did he die because of the animal? No, no. He died because he planted a circuit in the pet. Psychology, which is one of the more older and barbaric practices, which used to happen in a barbaric society known as Manhattan, one time did a very good job on this, and I've forgotten what they did, but I'm sure they did do a very, very good job on it. I'll think of it in a moment. It was something terribly important. Was it telepathy? No. They made some wise remark concerning this. And I'll think of it. It's that everybody had to adjust to his environment. That's right. That's right. And when the environment includes chimpanzees and cats and dogs and parents, children have a tendency to set up circuits. And the funny part of it is, if your child is very, very powerful, as a thing, he'll set up some of the most gall-dang circuits you ever heard of, which thereafter, to some degree, monitor the being they're set up on. I wouldn't dare tell you this if it weren't for the pain meter, because Einstein's laid down the precept that every observer must have a meter. And, by the way, we're going to send him one. We got this meter, and you can actually hold it on somebody, like we were doing the other day in class, and we hold it on somebody, and you can make it connect. Pain. That's a very funny thing, isn't it? That you can put a meter on somebody else's body and then make the meter work by simply monitoring the other person's body. That is the first meter proof. Quite important this would be to psychology. To Ryan, Ryan would stand around here and drool for days over this. He thinks this was the most wonderful thing that had ever happened. I can just see him now running all over Duke University making students ping. But what it does is objectively demonstrate that a circuit can be laid down in the body of another being and then it will operate. Well, how far this goes, I would hate to tell you. But some of your demon circuits aren't just set up by you. That's why you must always set up these machines in brackets. Have other people set up the machines, other people set up the machines for other people. Because who knows? You might have said, I'm not there to the tree and run into it and gotten a ridge, you see. Maybe somebody else ran into the tree and you ran into their ridge. Could be, you know. Remarkable, isn't it? Now, I don't say that anybody exchanges energy with anybody else, but somebody will certainly set up an energy pattern, which then influences somebody else. Change of space processing to the area where the pet died actually returns to the individual a portion of his personality which is lost when the pet died, because that portion of the personality died when the pet died, and it is a circuit which belongs to the individual. When he talked to the pet, he very conclusively talked to a circuit which is himself. A man training a pet can train a pet actually on this line. I have done this. I know what I'm talking about. I had a cat jump over a back fence in London, and I made the cat walk a picket fence which went all the way around a whole yard very carefully and then walked all around the picket fence again just by working its paws. Stupid cat. He didn't know what it was. Now, the truth of the matter is that animals don't go psychotic, really, until people have made pets of them. That was the real data I wanted to tell you about psychology. They said this one time. They got it out of a book the ancient Greeks wrote. And for copying that, they sent it down. Anyway, here is a fact. Here is a fact. You can monitor the behavior of an animal. Do you suppose for a moment that Clyde Beatty, while he's going through all of his act of being frightened of animals, is even vaguely frightened of animals? No, he's not. I know Clyde Beatty slightly. And I asked Clyde one day, I said, one of those animals came off with your back turned to him? What would you do? He said, isn't the question what I'll do. He won't come off the pedestal. And won't? Well, why not? Well, I put him there, and I'm still holding him there. 40 lions and tigers, see them simultaneously in the arena, never been worked before by man. 40 mixed lions and tigers. He evidently just sets up a certain beam on each one and says, pong. And he says to one, fight. The thing comes out, growls and snarls and so forth, and Beatty's body goes through an awful lot of action on the thing, and it looks so good. And Beatty's probably up there against a cage bar saying, okay, you fight, now you fight, now you fight, now you fight, now that's fine, withdraw. Then he has the body turn around and go this way when the band plays A major. I can tell you this very frankly, that people who cannot extend their own personality in any direction whatsoever, and who are all caved in, can't train animals. It's peculiar, isn't it? There's a certain formula, communication formula you're supposed to go through with training animals. You spank them, give them candy. Don't know as I ever spanked, gave candy to any animal I ever trained. Sometimes I picked them up and throw an appetite over a tin cup over my left shoulder, just for ornament's sake, when, in the early stages of training. But they got to be very good animals. I've always been very, very kind with animals, get along very well with animals, and it never occurred to me to be anything but a friend of an animal. Except one bulldog. He ran into a ridge, poor fellow. Well, anyway, this is, in pets, the same phenomena that man has employed evidently early on the track. So you have somebody with circuits who have been set up. Now, you take any auditor, you can have, this is interestingly enough, on a tape almost 2 years old. We're right back to where we started from, a lot of that early data. You can take somebody who has audited a great many preclears, and having pulled back the beam he still has on the preclear, you say, take it off of him. Take it off. I've had an auditor sit there sighing and wheezing with relief for about a half an hour, 45 minutes, while he pulled back beams from this preclear and that preclear and some other preclear. And I suppose the preclear wheezed with relief at the same moment. I suppose the preclear after that still went around saying, okay, I'll go over it again. Okay, I'll go over it again. In other words, this becomes pretty easily interconnected. Now, if you've never seen anything operate in terms of war, this won't mean too much to you. Because it has a volume, that one would not suspect. But let's take a ship. We'll put her in commission. We slide her down the roads and push her out to sea. And she's got a crew, and it's real green, and everybody's at each other's throats. Nobody's operating. The ship isn't operating inside the ship, and nothing's happening in the ship except squabbles and bad soup. And then somebody fires a shot at it in anger. And then maybe they fire another shot at it in anger. And then maybe it fires a couple shots in anger. And it comes home. It's a ship. It's very funny. I mean, it's just the difference between a dead body with maggots crawling on it and a live animal. There's a tremendous difference. Now, a ship that's been pummeled around is a group that's been knocked around who share the same causes and same goals. Now, if this group is in fairly good condition and actually has its goals going forward, it's operating to some slight degree as a single unit. Not because it's being monitored by any one individual, because it's developed to some degree a life of its own. How is it developing? It is a mutual life to which each one has contributed. And this is as solid and real as though you were putting your hands on an iron poker. It's not an unreal thing. If you want to know how man coheses together as man, there it is. An individual can detach himself from this ship, but he feels unhappy about it. But he gets over it and he joins another group. Of course, if it's a real good one, he probably never gets over it. That's what's happened to somebody on the track. People are stuck all over the place in associations which have been rendered apart. And if there's a real rugged association, which had a lot of combat in it, they're stuck in that real hard. Why? Well, they went downscale and they finally said, not I'm part of this group. They said, I'm not that other part. Well, generally, it had to start out that there was a mutual exchange between these two people. And this mutual exchange then wound up in a dogfight. And these two people then became estranged. And boy, there's nothing more better than a brother fighting a brother. And when you've got that situation with a preclear whereby he's been parted from people with whom this has occurred, you generally have included those points on the track. Why? He fought with this person so much that he developed the automaticity of, I'm not there, I'm here, because I'm fighting with this person. There's nothing more lost than a soldier after the war who could no longer look across to the enemy lines, the enemy trenches, the enemy redcoats, whatever it is, and say to himself, I'm not there. Bang. Oh boy, he's certain as long as that goes on, then all of a sudden you don't show him any more field green jackets, you show him no more redcoats, no more parapets, no more trenches, no more enemy submarines, nothing. He can never say to himself, I'm not there, because he's got to say it now with violence. The only reason he has to say it with violence is because it's been lowered down tone scale to a point where he depends upon impacts to give him certainty. Put him in good shape, you just had to bring him up to tone scale to a point where he didn't depend upon impact to show him certainty. How do you do this? You maybe exteriorize him by any way, shape, or form that you can and get him stabilized with regard to his own universe, the mesh universe, and other people's universes. That's all. It's awfully easy. If anything happens to this individual and he slumps and he still has ideas about this and that and he bogs here and there and words still bother him, or he dives precipitately, immediately, instantly into other people's troubles and starts getting himself all involved with those again instead of standing off and solving them. You have an individual who is not well oriented in three universes. That's all. I mean, let's throw the significance away and the balderdash and the monkey business and stop the beating of the drum and the magic word and the center button that is inside the center button that's inside the center button, which if you press magically his universe and this universe and another part of the universe explode. Somebody's gotten mixed up, they're back on the train track fighting an atomic war or in the future fighting the next one here. But all it is disorientation. Now, a certainty of orientation an instant before a disorientation makes a something nothingness, which is tremendously effective. The person then can even be certain that he now knows something which he can't put his finger on. Now, this is the patient coming out of the ether and suddenly saying, you know, I now know a terrible secret and I don't dare tell anybody. Sure he does. He was under anesthesia and somebody was holding him down and the anesthesia was holding him down and then he picked up a sledgehammer or something of the sort and broke the bone again. And out of all this anesthesia, he was vitally and lively awake for just an instant. In other words, out of this ocean of real, unconscious, gone nothingness, there is this sudden, sharp island of certainty. Oh boy, is he puzzled now. He's as puzzled as somebody trying to navigate a ship across Bristol Bay and put it down in the Pribilofs. There's 10 clear days up there a year, or there was 1 year. I think the next was two. Well, that was the record year. Fog and the wind goes 180 miles an hour. Anyway, with the fog. This is just about what he does. See, he starts sailing in through the course of life, and all of a sudden, he's uncertain. He loses a wife, a pet, a cow. He loses something. Or she loses a husband, or a dog, or a Ford. And something that she's imbued with a personality that has actually cost this person part of the personality. After that, he goes around, or she goes around, under the delusion that some piece of her personality has been taken away from her. She'd swear to it. She'd swear that something of me has gone. It has been stolen from me. You have then the basic theory of vampirism. Well, sure there was. He put something in the other person or the other object, and then it left. Well, what's wrong here? The only thing that's really wrong is the person can't orient a part of its beingness. See? I mean, you can exteriorize this preclear. But this preclear is so involved with trying to exteriorize himself in Keokuk, where the girl left when she went back to mother, that you don't ever get a chance to get him out of his head. It's other person's problems. He's trying to get him out of some other head. Because he knows part of him is gone. Well, the whole idea of quantity where life is concerned is an absurdity.